supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. You know, it seems all too often we are exposed to the news that someone, somewhere, has lashed out unexpectedly and violently at others in a very public way. Just last week, a man went on a shooting rampage that left 7 dead in a California Christian university. Last month, a U.S. soldier was held accountable for a killing spree in Afghanistan that led to the deaths of many villagers, including children. In both cases, we're told that the alleged perpetrators didn't seem capable of such horrific behavior. Excuse me, the full stories of these tragedies still need to be pierced together, and as they are, we're still left wondering what causes an apparently regular person to lose it so powerfully. Is there a buildup? Is there a pathway to violence? Do we have a sense of why people seem to snap and become violent? And how do communities react? And how do they heal after things have gone so terribly wrong? On today's show, we'll be talking about this with three guests. Carla Rogers is a forensic psychiatrist and a fitness for duty consultant. She's also on the teaching faculty here at the University of Pennsylvania, and she joins us here in the studio. Carla, welcome.
Thank you, Dan. Nice to be here.
Peter Ash is also a forensic psychiatrist. He's a child psychiatrist and an associate professor at Emory University. He joins us by phone from Georgia. Peter, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And Roderick Orner is a clinical psychologist, visiting professor at the University of Lincoln in Lincolnshire, England. He specializes in trauma and visited his native country, Norway, following the massacre that occurred there last summer. Roderick, welcome to the show.
Oh, and thank you very much, and thank you for inviting me to come on the show.
Yeah, my pleasure. Our number, if you want to join the conversation, is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Peter, let's start with you.
Okay.
13 years ago, almost to the day, it happened in April, Eric Harris, Dylan Klebold ravaged their own Columbine High School, killed 12 students and one teacher, injuring 21 others. Then they committed suicide. This seemed to be the first of a very long and continuing series of school shootings. In the aftermath, we heard that these two boys were rejected, alienated, and ostracized by their fellow students. So what's the relationship between rejection, isolation, and violence?
Well, I think it's fairly clear that a lot of the school shooters felt isolated and rejected. But, of course, it's important to understand that only a very, very small number of people who feel that way go on to actually become violent. School shootings are really quite rare. And they also tend, it's interesting, to seem to cluster in time, that for a long time there weren't any, then there was kind of a flurry, and then more recently, as far as school shootings, meaning elementary school, middle school, and high school, they've been a lot less common over the last couple of years, fortunately. So it seemed to have come in a big wave.
Take a guess about why.
Well, we don't... Why the wave? I think that there's a certain... I don't want to say copycat, it's not that strong, but for a long time it was as though it just wasn't something anybody thought about. And then once it happened, other people who were inclined or potentially thinking of doing such things had models, and they saw the fame and attention and notoriety that others got, and that seemed to probably have some releasing effect. I think then the wave dropped off because after the Columbine shooting, there were massive interventions in schools to try and prevent such things. In particular, one of the commonalities of the school shootings, different from some of the adult shootings that have happened more recently, but in the school shootings is that it turned out that virtually all of the shooters had made a threat or some kind of statement to other students, but the other students really didn't take it seriously.
Well,
and so it never got reported.
Yeah, and you know, at what point does who take what seriously? I want to turn to you, Carly. You reacted, especially when Peter talked about interventions in
right.
school subsequent to.
Well, I think that's been a critical issue. I've been very active with the Philadelphia Psychiatric Society, and we actually had a contest for a while for high school students called When Not to Keep a Secret. And these were essays, and I was one of the reviewers. We reviewed the essays, and when does somebody tell you something that indicates they or someone else may be in danger? And there is this peer cohesion, and there is the feeling that, well, you don't want to be the guy who snitches. But there are times when an individual should not keep a secret, and it's hard to break that teenage adolescent cohesion. And we had quite a few submissions. In addition to that, there was also an intervention in terms of assessing people for school violence that was headed up by Dr. Paul Fink locally. So I think a lot of communities, including the Philadelphia community, have reacted.
When is it time?
When is it time?
When is it time to share a secret? When we hear, how do we know?
Well, it was interesting to get the kids' responses, and because we didn't tell them.
Well,
told us.
I want you to tell us. I mean,
okay.
how do we know? Everybody says, I could kill that person.
I think when it gets repetitive, when it gets specific. So, sure, I'm sure we've all yelled at family members or spouses, you know, I could just kill you. That's different than when it is repeated and repeated so that the idea becomes fixed within the individual, and I'm going to get a gun and shoot you, or I could stab you. So I think, just like with suicide, when there is more of a plan and there is repetition, then we need to share that.
These attacks are planned.
Certainly, you alluded to Columbine, and it was clear there was planning that went on there. Certainly, we're not going to be able to prevent all violence, but I think the idea that people just, quote, snap, close quote, is probably less common than we think. And if we look, it takes a certain amount of effort to gather weapons. It takes a certain amount of effort to stalk your prey, if you will. So I think there's probably more planning than we realize.
If, Peter, if there is planning, if there is progression, what does that look like internally and externally? I know I'm asking you to generalize here, and I know that's unfair, but give it a shot.
Well, I think there's a pathway to violence. That is, as Carla pointed out, these mass killings are not impulsive acts. And when you do get into the mind of the person who did it, it turns out that there is a pathway to violence that extended over quite some time, which allows you, if you can see it, then, of course, to intervene. It starts with sort of just thinking about it. Maybe in the context of having grudges and resentments and thinking about revenge in a kind of general way. It then tends to move to more interest in violence, so that in some of these people you see they're looking at websites about other violent incidents, or they're reading books about it, or they're reading the journals of assassins, or that sort of thing. With that, there's a fascination with weapons that builds, and they get interested. And then there's moving into more action, where they actually get weapons, make lists potentially of targets, scope out where they're actually going to carry it out, stalk victims potentially, up to killing. Yes.
Can you talk about, and this is where the unfair question comes in, can you talk about what's happening internally with these people?
Right. Well, first it's important to realize that they're different kinds of personality constellations. Not all of these people are the same by any means.
Are they all mentally ill?
Well, depends on what you mean by mentally ill.
Well,
they aren't normal folks, that's for sure. Let me put it that way. Well, there's a lot of personality disorders. Some people are actually psychotic, but certainly by no means all of them are psychotic. Many of them are not.
You sighed, Carla, when I asked that question.
Yeah.
I know that's a difficult question.
You bet, and I'm certainly not a good poker player, am I?
No.
But I sighed because we say in our culture, oh, he must have been crazy or she must be crazy to do X, Y, or Z, because I think it's frightening to us to realize that perhaps we inside or family members or friends may have the capacity to commit a horrendous act of violence against another. So I think the idea of putting violent individuals into that other category, that crazy category, is helpful in terms of us just coping. And I also wanted to bring up the issue that you can be fine, but under, let's say, the influence of substances or alcohol, this is certainly a factor. And somebody who is not drinking or who is not drugging may be angry and isolated and so forth, but if they get enough disinhibiting substance within them, they may actually act on their feelings. And I think this is an underrated risk factor outside of the mental health community. Of course, we in mental health know about the disinhibiting factor of drug and alcohol. But this certainly, I see a lot of drugs and alcohol in the people I evaluate in my practice who've committed violent crimes.
Well, as long as we're talking about mental illness, Roderick, I want to turn to you. Last July, there was a series of attacks, first on a government building in Oslo, and then at a summer camp, and nearly 80 people were killed, many more injured, and this was clearly a planned, methodical attack, which was really surprising to me because the perpetrator was later diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia, and he was psychotic at the time of the incident. That's kind of confusing to me.
Yes, and you know, this is actually something that is very, very controversial. And although two psychiatrists have made this diagnosis, there are many, many who disagree with it for the very same reasons that Dr. Ash and Dr. Rogers have said. It becomes a question, really, of, you know, how mentally ill do you have to be to spend nearly 10 years planning and then executing a very complicated series of terrorist actions like Breivik did in Oslo. I don't think the idea of mental illness helps us understand what happened in Oslo and in Norway.
What does help us, Roderick?
Well, I think you have to look at the things that have been alluded to, which is really what is the situation of the person who does these acts of extreme violence. What have been their recent life circumstances? What have their relationships been like? And I think the one thing that I think we learn from events in Norway is that the people who are not willing to engage in conversation, in debate, in discussion, these are the people who can often be the most dangerous.
Hmm. I want to address an issue that comes up here, Peter, and that's about post-traumatic stress disorder. Sergeant Robert Bales allegedly murdered over a dozen Afghan citizens in early March, and there's a lot of evidence that might suggest that he had pretty severe PTSD, or all of the things Roderick talked about, difficulties in relationships and situations and exposed to war repeatedly. And by one estimate, PTSD happens to nearly 20% of the soldiers who serve in Iraq. So what's the difference? What's the relationship between PTSD and violence?
We don't know, or at least I don't know, with particular respect to Sergeant Bales, how it worked out. But in looking at people generally who have committed mass murders, PTSD does not figure very strikingly as a cause. So it may have played out in his mind in an important way, but overall, that's not usually what we think. One of the interesting things about the mass shooters and making them hard to predict is that they present very differently from the people who tend to be individual killers, in that we usually think as mental health professionals that the key predictor of future violence is past violence. The remarkable thing about the mass killers is they very frequently don't have a history of past violence, so our best predictor doesn't work. And so they are a very different kind of bunch. So it makes it very hard for us to generalize from people who kill individuals or family members, that sort of thing, to these mass killers. Certainly, in the individual killers, PTSD, I think, plays a bigger role. But in the mass killers, while it may be important for him, it's not generally, in my experience, a major issue.
Carl, we've got to take a break. But I wonder if you could just quickly address, before we do, the relationship between PTSD and violence, maybe not necessarily mass killings, but PTSD and violence.
Yeah, I'll just say briefly that I was involved in a case recently where this was an issue in terms of a single violent act of a former serviceman, very serious act, and there was an issue in terms of mitigating circumstances. He did have PTSD. He was, for whatever reasons, unable to get treatment. And I think we see that more and more. I would agree with Peter that it seems to be more of a one-on-one, relational, in this case it had to do with a husband and wife situation, and less of that planning. I think with the people who plan these big events, there is more of a calculating aspect, less of an impulsive aspect, and perhaps we certainly have the MacArthur research studies to show us that paranoia often gets involved in these large mass killings.
Mm-hmm. Like I said, we've got to take a short break, and we'll be right back. We are talking about these mass killings that seem to take place spontaneously, but we're learning they really don't. They build up over time and they're all calculated. We're going to hear more about what happens on the inside, what happens to the community, and what we can do to contribute to healing in both. My guests are forensic psychiatrist Carla Rogers, who's here at Penn, and Peter Ash, who's at Emory University. We're also joined on the phone by Roderick Orner, who specializes in trauma, and he's with the University of Lincoln in Lincolnshire, England. Our number is 888-477-9233. 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. We've got a couple of open lines, and we'll be taking your calls in the second segment of our show. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
Supporting WHYY HEAL, Holistic Enrichment of Adult Living. HEAL offers health advocacy, companion caregiving, and consultative services to adults with acute and chronic medical conditions. HEAL develops a personalized plan of care for each client. HEAL then provides a quality assurance program to track satisfaction and closely monitor service and outcomes. Their goal is to holistically support an enriched, independent, and healthy lifestyle. Information about HEAL is available online at healconsultants.org.
On the next Fresh Air, psychological anthropologist Tanya Lerman, author of When God Talks Back, Understanding the American Evangelical Relationship with God.
These folks were invited to put out a second cup of coffee for God while they prayed, to go for a walk with God, to go on a date with God.
Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
We're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We are talking about people who commit these mass murders, these mass acts of violence, with forensic psychiatrist Carla Rogers and Peter Ash, and psychologist Roderick Orner. Peter, the 22-year-old gunman who murdered six people and wounded 14 others in his attempt to assassinate Gabriel Giffords in Arizona last year. He was posting on YouTube, like you suggested earlier, about how much he hated the government. Well, you know, a lot of people hate the government these days, but this young man took it a step further. It's almost as though his cognitive functions just stopped working, and he was being controlled by his emotions.
Well, I think that there's quite a bit of evidence that the suspect, Mr. Loughner, has actually a fairly severe mental illness. As you know, he was found incompetent to stand trial. There's been a whole lot of court issues about force medicating him in the sense he needs medication, so that he's one of these people who I think is on the clearly mentally ill side of the spectrum. Which is, then, it's when you're into that and you have delusional material and psychotic thinking, then, of course, people put together all kinds of very strange ideas and delusions which can motivate them to act. What we still don't know, obviously, most of the mentally ill, that psychosis by itself is not a particular risk factor for being violent. It's not like the mentally ill are violent. It's just that when the mentally ill are violent, they may have some very idiosyncratic ways of thinking about it.
I do want to talk about that before we go any further. Are people with mental illness much more likely than anyone else to become violent? Because, you know, the lay population is already afraid of people with mental illness. Carla, how about if you address that?
Well, that's an interesting question. There are certain individuals with a certain kind of mental illness that involves paranoia, that involves specific command hallucinations or voices in their head telling them to do a violent act. Those kinds of individuals, again, we're looking at the MacArthur study data, are more likely to be violent. But mental illness across the board, actually less likely. There were some FBI statistics a few years ago that said that 3% of violent crimes in this nation were committed by the mentally ill, but there are 10% of the population that has, or there is 10% that has an actual diagnosed mental illness, perhaps more. So in terms of their representation in the population, they're actually less violent. But there is a subset that can be dangerous.
Let's go to the phones. We've got John on the line. Hey, John, you're on Voices. John? Do we have you? We've got a glitch. We'll try to get back to him. We're talking, by the way, about people who commit these mass murders. If you want to join the conversation, our number is 888-477-9499. Carla, you do consulting.
I do.
With a defense contractor, and your consulting involves assessing whether a potential employee is fit for duty.
That's correct.
If you will. So, what's a common scenario that an employer is worried about, and how do you assess?
Well, one of the issues, and again, I don't specialize in violent risk assessment. There is a gentleman named Park Dietz, who's one of the stars in our field, whose specialty that is. But almost always when an employer gets in touch with me, particularly someone like a defense contractor or school boards, I've worked for several school boards, they do want to know a potential for violence. And, you know, I don't have a crystal ball, but I do go through some of the risk factors. Are these individuals connected to the community, to a religious institution, or someplace where they can vent their feelings, feel that they're supported? What are their relationships at work? How do they feel about their employers? Do they have access to weapons? How familiar are they with weapons? You know, I don't believe that familiarity breeds contempt for weapons, but it does breed a comfort level. So are these weapons kept in a secure manner? Do they have issues with drug and alcohol, which I already alluded to? So there are certain questions where you can guesstimate, and I do want to make it clear that it's not a hard and fast black and white, yes, they could be violent, no, they can't be. But you do make an assessment. Of course, as Peter said earlier, the biggest predictor, except in these mass murder kind of situations of future violence, is previous violence. So if somebody has a history, let's say, of domestic abuse, I weight that fairly heavily. Or if they themselves were abused as a child, I would certainly consider that.
Yeah, I want to turn to you, Roderick. Your specialty is trauma. And, you know, I just want to follow up on what Carla said. There's a variety of childhood stressors that put people at risk, like, you know, a history of physical sexual abuse, witnessing parental fighting, growing up in poverty, and on, but still only a minority of those people who grow up with these stressors become violent. What's the difference?
Well, I think we have to take then as a sort of given, really, that with those who are subjected to abuse and neglect and have terrible experiences during childhood, there'll always be like a propensity in some way to kind of repeat or recreate that awfulness. And then, of course, then your question is, well, how come it doesn't happen to everyone?
Right.
We don't know why it doesn't happen to everyone, but of course, one of the things that is important, one of the things that reduces the risks is if somebody has at least one good relationship, and they have they know intimacy, they know closeness to another, and they have different role models. But in the end, I think the most important risk factor is really the amount of social support that is available to a particular individual at any one time, and also I think as Dr. Rogers was saying, you have to look at the current situation of the person and what's going on in their lives. You know, are they going through very stressful periods of time, and may there have been an accumulation of stresses, and then we just know that these are contributory factors that could make almost anyone flip and act in a manner deemed to be out of character.
You know, Roderick, you talked about significant relationships, and as an aside, you know, I speak with a lot of people who've overcome horrible trauma. And who have done well, and you know, they all have a variety of different explanations for why, but everyone says has one thing in common. And they all say, there was someone who believed in me right when I needed it. And I think that really addresses not only the power of relationships, but the power we all have to make a significant impact on the world. Just one person
absolutely.
Who believes.
And you know, one of the things that's marvelous about that is that, you know, it doesn't actually take psychologists or psychiatrists to do this. What is offered in ordinary social support is something that kind of, you know, works against some of the kind of really bad influences to which we are subjected when we are left on our own, or when we are lonely, or when we are being attacked or abused by others. We know this from studies in the United Kingdom of looking at the outcome after trauma, and look at various predictors, and you know, social support, just as you said, is by far the most important variable, and actually, it is as a single variable, it is more important than all the other variables put together. Can you imagine?
Yeah, and that is obviously much more powerful than psychotherapy and medication. We don't like to talk too much about that because we're all trying to make a living here, but you know, that's just the truth, and that means everybody can do something to help. Well, we've got John back on the line. John, hi, you're on Voices. Do we have you? Nope. Still don't. All right. We will. John? No. All right. We will try again. We'll see how our lines are doing. I know there's a lot of people who want to join the conversation, and we will get to you post haste. Yeah, please.
I just wanted to follow up on what Roderick said. And you're right. We all want to make a living, but you have to do what works. And I am involved, and I can't go into detail, obviously, but I am involved with a patient who has had criminal charges and was not doing well. And I'll tell you, this person has a wonderful family. And I can call the family up and say, hey, I think so-and-so is really not doing so well. Can you call him up and bring him over and so forth? It's like having an extra pair of eyes, an extra brain, and it's made all the difference for this patient. So when you can get family members, church members, some sort of club, volunteer, whatever, layperson involved, it makes all the difference in terms of treatment.
Well, let me follow that up, what all of us are saying. We hear a lot these days about mirror neurons, and mm-hmm. these are the cells that fire when we watch someone engage in kindness or when we watch someone engage in violence. Violent. So I wonder if the internet or violent video games is one of our callers wants to address, increases the risk of violent fantasies becoming violent actions.
Well, I don't know about the research on the internet. I do know there's been some research done on television that goes back 20 years or so, and it was inconclusive. There were some researchers that felt, yes, it did increase violent television shows, and watching X number of people get killed did increase violence, and some researchers felt not. So I don't think there's a definitive answer.
Well, in the ensuing years, though, video games have become more violent, more accessible, and more realistic. Roderick Orner, do you have any research on that?
No, the situation here, as far as we understand it, is that it is unclear. And I think there are just so many confounding considerations. And you can't just say, well, you know, if you took 1,000 people and they watched violent videos or video games, then, you know, they would all become violent. It doesn't work like that. I think there may be that, let's say, somebody who is present with a particular risk for certain types of behavior, if they are exposed to a lot of violence on in the media, then it sort of may play into their fantasies. But just an exposure to violence is not necessarily something that's going to cause in everyone a repetition of that behavior.
Peter Ash, I want to switch gears here a bit. When these incidents happen, you know, we hear language like nutcase or evil. Blogger Jennifer Kessler suggested that although many of these people might seem nice and unassuming, she said they're really just being manipulative. Your thoughts?
Well, I don't know about manipulative. A lot of them, I think, feel very vengeful. They feel that they've had a raw deal, that their relationships tend to be tinged with, they see it as other people have not given them their due, have been mean to them, that they are very, they're thinking about relationships, but they tend to think them in a negative way, and they tend to be sort of loners. And then they may act out against those people. So it's a kind of, for many people, it's a sort of vengeful getting back. I don't know if I'd call that manipulative quite, but it has a vengeful kind of relationship.
So although these incidents, and I'll turn back to you, Carla, look very chaotic, are they aiming for certain people or certain kinds of people? Like if someone was kind to them, will they be safe?
Yes to all. Some of them are more chaotic than others. Other individuals may be looking for certain people. In part, it depends upon the ideology of the violence. And if you go back years and years to one of the first mass killings, Charles Whitman in the tower at the University of Texas. He had, I mean, this was a great, upstanding young man, a veteran, so forth. And it turned out that, and he climbed the tower and just started picking people off at random. It turned out that on autopsy, he was discovered to have a brain tumor. So I think part of whether or not it's planned, how well it's planned, and if there is a specific, may well have to do with the nature of the individual and their pathology.
Good point. We've got to take a short break, and when we come back, I want to talk to all three of you about the legal issues with these perpetrators and the whole insanity plea and what that means, and hopefully Roderick will talk to us about healing communities in the aftermath of all this. We're talking about these mass murders when people seem like they are snapping and what happens internally, externally, and its impact on the community. We are talking with Carla Rogers, who's a forensic psychiatrist here at the University of Pennsylvania. Peter Ash is also a forensic psychiatrist at Emory. Roderick Orr is a psychologist at the University of Lincoln in Lincolnshire who specializes in trauma. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. We are doing everything we can to get to the phones, and hopefully we will take your calls after this short break. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
Plan of Pennsylvania supports WHYY, created by families for families. Plan of PA offers planning, trust, and care management services to adults with mental differences in the 5-county Greater Philadelphia area. Plan of PA services are designed to help families address the care and support of their adult family member with special needs in response to the question, who will care for my loved one when I am no longer able? More information at planofpa.org or 610-687-4036.
We've heard about anti-gay activism in Uganda. Now the rhetoric is heating up in Liberia, and observers fear it could boil over into violence.
There needs to be some sort of action before it really spirals out of control.
But why this effort to target gays, and why now? We'll try to find out next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We are talking about these acts of violence that seem pretty random, but they're really not. We're talking with forensic psychiatrists Carla Rogers and Peter Ash and psychologist Roderick Orner. I want to talk with you, Roderick, about what happened to the community in Oslo, Norway. This is a peace-loving country that hasn't been exposed to this kind of violence. What impact did it have, and what the healing process look like?
Well, it actually had an extraordinary effect on the whole nation, but on the individual communities, and especially in and around Oslo. The whole incident with Breivik was a terrorist attack on democracy, on nationhood, and a whole way of life that is well established. I think people were shocked. It was actually so difficult to get people to talk about what had happened because they were just in complete shock and didn't know how to express what they felt. But what then happened, and it was extraordinary because it happened really without any kind of, there was no central planning or no organization around this. People just came together, and in a country that where people are quite reticent really about turning to neighbors and to the wider community for help and support, it just became the natural way that people came together, and people started talking to one another in the street and giving sympathy, and there was a high level of distress throughout the community, and the community kind of came to realize that, well, distress is not a disorder. What we need is we need somebody close. We need somebody to talk to. We need to feel some intimacy and closeness with others. And people just set about and created that for themselves. It was marvelous.
You know, it sounds like a bit about what we're talking about when you talked about how we need someone when we're in trouble. You just need another human. And I was thinking about the mirror neurons. You know, you see someone who's vulnerable. I'm a quadriplegic, and I just watch people's response to me. You know, when we see vulnerability, it tends to open our hearts. And, you know, now your neighbor's vulnerable because you're vulnerable, and it just kind of encourages, almost on a neurological level, this kind of openness and closeness. Carla?
Well, I think we saw some of what Roderick was describing here after 9/11. I was up in New York not long after that terrible incident, and everybody was so kind, nice, pleasant. We're so glad to see you. We're glad to have visitors in our city. And certainly you saw that in Philadelphia. People are holding doors open for each other and just spontaneously talking. So I think you're absolutely correct. Yeah. And we do see that with large traumatic incidences that affect the community.
Why didn't it last, Carla?
Oh, I think you might.
There's that sigh again.
I think you might have to ask Jane Goodall, who's the chimp specialist.
I'll ask Peter.
Okay.
Well, I think people, after they're reacting to an immediate thing, and even though they get a lot of comfort out of it, they tend to go back to the way things were. And it's interesting to notice that the other side of the same coin is that many of these mass murders we're talking about are precipitated by the loss of a relationship. Relationships are so important, and when people undergo a loss, that's one of the big risk factors for their lashing out.
Hmm. Let's.
Can I come in?
Please, please.
This whole point about how we pick up signals from other people when they're in distress, and we can't be then indifferent to it. We know this from some studies in the traumatic stress field that actually, you know, things like crying. Is something that's actually highly adaptive, because when we cry, other people notice. And it's the same with facial gestures. You know, we human beings are hardwired to pick up certain signals of distress. And of course, then we reach out and we help towards the survival of those who are distressed or who are in difficulty. And I think part of the reason why it doesn't continue is that with the support that, for instance, happened in Norway, after a while, it was as if it kind of like returned to normal again, and these signals of distress and difficulty, they were no longer being emitted. So people revert to habitual patterns of behavior.
I also want to suggest that images of strength and bravado trigger defensiveness and distance in others. So, you know, when we hide our vulnerability, we get just the opposite of what we really need, and that's kindness and connection. Peter, I want to talk about what options we may or may not have, and I want to talk about John Bendel, who on May 4th, 2010, when the Pentagon shot two police officers. But he was described as a gentleman and a computer genius who was withdrawn. But his family knew he had bipolar disorder, and they were trying to get help for him. He occasionally saw a psychiatrist who was desperately trying to get him stabilized on medication, so we know he was at risk. But what are our options in a free society?
The options are fairly limited in those cases when a person doesn't want help. Obviously, the first step is to try and encourage the individual to seek help and cooperate with help and with treatment. If they won't, then usually, unless the person seems imminently dangerous to themselves or other people, you can't do much. If they are imminently dangerous, then you can force treatment or at least hospitalization in most places. But if they're not, in a free society, it's the price we pay. And we saw this problem, obviously, in the Virginia Tech shooting with Mr. Cho, who had been to mental health, gotten committed, released, really didn't get any help in the interim, and then became violent in the tragedy at Virginia Tech. So it's...
I said before our break, I'll turn to you, Carla. What are your thoughts about the insanity defense?
Well, first of all, I think people need to understand that the insanity defense is not the same in every single state. Individual states are allowed to create their own statutes regarding this particular issue. Many of the states in our country, the majority currently, go with the McNaughton standard. And the McNaughton standard, or some variation on the McNaughton standard, is that individuals either don't know what they're doing is against the law, and or they don't understand the nature of the act. So if I'm going out and shooting a gun, but I think I'm waving a bubble maker around. It has to be at that level. And I think that's a very, people don't realize that's a very, very tough standard.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not as easy
sounds. We have this mythology about it's so easy to get an insanity.
And people get off. I am going to close the show a bit early today because I want to comment on the recent death of Mike Wallace. I want to thank all three of you so much for joining us. Forensic psychiatrist Carla Rogers and Peter Ash. Thank you so much, Roderick Orner, clinical psychologist over there at University of Lincoln in Lincolnshire. You've been great and informative. I'm sure, as many of you know, CBS commentator Mike Wallace passed away a few days ago at age 93. Well, about 20 years ago, this powerful public figure took the courageous step of acknowledging his own experience with major depression. He joined forces with Pulitzer Prize-winning author Bill Styron and columnist and humorist Art Buchwald, who also had spoken publicly about their depression. They jokingly called themselves the Blues Brothers. Who knows how many lives were saved because Wallace took ownership of his illness. We never know what impact it has when we openly talk about something that is often seen as shameful. When I speak about my own history of depression with high school students, I always have several of them come up to me and tell me they've just found the word that they're depressed, and they ask me how they can get help. Next week's show will be about mental illness and self-acceptance. And we all have role models like Mike Wallace to thank for that. Also on the evening of Monday, April 16th, I'll be speaking in Delaware on the topic of living with a mood disorder and building positive relationships. You can get more information about that on my website, drdangottlieb.com. And you can reach our production team here at Voices at WHYY.org. To download today's show, go to WHYY.org/voices. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez Luna is our executive producer of audio content. Emily Haas is our volunteer. Mark Sonero is our intern. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Jennifer Lynn is our producer. I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week, my friends.